everyone, Stephen Cloud here, back with another episode. If you can, donate to me at patreon.com/thepeaceandlibertypodcast. And any donations will be used to keep the show going. And of course, us libertarians believe in voluntary donations to support the causes you want to support. Today, I'm going to be giving an overview of what exactly is Austrian economics. If you remember last episode, we discussed Karl Menger and his breakthroughs regarding marginal utility and subjective value. We discussed Eugen Böhm-Bawerk, who made many contributions to value, price, capital, and interest. And of course, Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard. All these guys could be credited with making economics whole per se. Now, an episode like this, I could easily go on for hours. And if you know me, I like to do short episodes packed with info. So I'm going to go over a lot of concepts. And by the end, you'll have a very solid foundation to piece this all together and make sense of it all. I guess to start, in relation to Austrian economics, we need to first define what economics is. Now, one common definition you'll hear, and it's not completely inaccurate, is that economics is the study of how scarce resources are allocated. Yes, that's partially true, but the main difference between, say, Austrian economics and mainstream economics is that Austrian economics begins on a self-evident axiom, namely that humans act to exchange one state of affairs for a more satisfactory state of affairs. It's also crucial to understand that a quote-unquote satisfactory state of affairs is subjective to each individual. Take a masochist, for example. The average person would not consider it an improvement to get beaten and whipped during sexual intercourse, yet this would be an improvement to a masochist. So whether or not a person's goals are benevolent, malevolent, or self-harming, the idea still holds true. So what does this all mean? Well, it means that true economics is deduced philosophically. It's not as if we start off with these universal equations such as profit equals revenue minus resources, but that we deduce these universalities through reason. Now, praxeology, which is the study of human action, this is the backbone of Austrian economics. There are criticisms of this. For example, Thomas Mayer argues that because praxeology rejects positivism and empiricism, that it rejects the scientific method. This couldn't be further from the truth. All Austrian economists would argue is that despite your so-called empirical research that seems to show a raise in the minimum wage doesn't lead to unemployment, Austrians would argue this data is simply wrong. It's unfalsifiable that if you increase a firm's labor costs artificially, these costs will get offset. They will get offset. Either the prices of the goods and services will rise or people will get laid off. And experience shows us that the employer is much more comfortable with the latter scenario, as the former scenario will cost some customers. So in essence, economic laws are both deduced and unfalsifiable. Again, despite what the so-called data says, the data can simply be wrong. That's a huge point to understand. Now, you can imagine why Mises fought so bitterly with logical positivists, because they argue that nothing is true until you can falsify and test the ideas. So next, I'll cover a broad range of topics. And again, I could spend hours talking about each topic individually. First, I'll talk about subjective value. Many of you may have heard of the labor theory of value espoused by Adam Smith, Karl Marx, etc. And what this theory said is that the value of any good is related to the amount of labor hours that went into it. For example, if you have a shirt that took 4 hours to produce and a pair of shoes that took 8 hours to produce, Marx would conclude that one shirt is half the value of a pair of shoes and vice versa. One pair of shoes is equal to the value of two shirts. There is also this diamond water paradox, because we can abstract that water is more useful than diamonds. If you don't have water, you'll die. On the other hand, diamonds fetch a very high price in the market in contrast with water, yet they almost have no use value. So this is called the exchange use paradox, in which it was theorized that goods of a high exchange value will have very little use value, and vice versa. Now, Karl Menger flipped this all on its head when he pointed out that for any transaction to take place, both parties must feel they'll benefit from the transaction. And what ends up happening is that, as you mentioned before, both parties will be trading a less satisfactory state of affairs for a more satisfactory state of affairs. So if I'm willing to give up, say, a basketball for a video game, it means that I value the basketball less than I value the video game, and the person trading me values the basketball more. Again, this is so easily deduced that it wouldn't matter if a study came out of the Quarterly Journal of Economics saying that both parties didn't benefit. Incorrect data doesn't falsify the unfalsifiable ideas. Again, incorrect data can't falsify this unfalsifiable idea. So related to diamonds, Menger would point out that the reason people pay so much for them is because they value the diamonds to that extent. They feel they're better off with a diamond than a large sum of money. As does happen, they do give up that money. Now, people viewing who are married may remember quite well giving up a large sum of money at Jared's to make your spouse happy. But here's the key, and this is what blows the labor theory of value out of the water. Menger asks you, imagine you have two identical diamonds. One, you simply found on the ground as you were walking, and the second one resulted from mining for, say, 10 years to get that diamond. Menger points out that despite, obviously, a lot of labor time went into mining that diamond for 10 years, and the other guy just found a diamond. These diamonds will both sell for the same price in the market. Really think about that. The first diamond had, for all intents and purposes, no labor hours embedded into it, while the second diamond had hundreds of thousands of hours. And if this example blew your mind and connected the dots, yeah, imagine how Menger felt. That's why when he was writing Principles of Economics, he was full of joy. These were stunning revelations. So on that note, that's the idea behind subjective value. The prices we see in the market, at least in the absence of government and price manipulation, are a reflection of all the subjective evaluations from each individual consumer. This comes back to the idea that only individuals act. See, one thing macroeconomics attempts to do is to forget about the individual. Let's just think about everything in big aggregates. So rather than the economic situation of a country being based on choices of individual actors, it tries to create blanket statements showing that it's monetary policy that affects the country or tariffs or whatever. This is why Austrians argue so much with macroeconomists. All economics starts with the individual. Marginal utility, I touched on this briefly last episode, but I don't feel like I gave a good enough definition. So to start, marginal, the way it was translated over from Latin, means border. And the word utility means satisfaction or happiness. So the original phrase would have meant something like border satisfaction. So what this is supposed to represent is that the amount of satisfaction you as an individual will get from an additional unit of a good. Let's take an example. Suppose you're in the desert and you have 1 gallon of water. Now, when you get extremely thirsty, you need to drink. That first sip satisfies your most immediate desires. You're infinitely better off with that first sip than you were compared to having consumed no water at all. That second sip and third sip and fourth sip may satisfy your desires further, but at an increasing rate. So if we just back up a second and think, okay, I'm going to start drinking this water. And at some point, I won't be able to drink anymore. Capacity of our stomach, maybe clouds cover the sun, and then it would be a waste to drink more, etc. So at some point, an additional unit of water would make us throw up or whatever. It'd be a declining marginal utility. And each unit would make you worse off than before. So marginal utility begins on an upward curve. That first sip, you're getting a lot of satisfaction. That second sip, you know, it's satisfying thirst, but a little bit less. Hopefully that makes sense. Just over time, the utility of what you're consuming goes down and down and down. It might go up, but at a decreasing rate. All right, interest. Now, this is probably the most important to understand because Austrians view the interest rate as the most important price in the economy. Many of you might understand what interest is at a basic level, and that it describes a relationship between a creditor and a borrower. And if I borrow, say, $100 at 10% per week interest, then in 10 weeks, I'll owe the creditor $200. Another important thing to remember, and this leads to a lot of conspiracy theories, is that the charging of interest is banned in Christianity, Islam, and sort of with Judaism. The reason I say sort of with Judaism is that you're forbidden only from charging interest to other Jews, but you can charge interest to non-Jews. Now, originally, this was termed usury, and this was outright banned. This outright banned all charging of interest. But what usury came to mean was charging an extremely high interest rate or an unreasonably high interest rate. Take, for example, a payday loan business. Sure, you can make the argument that they gain their wealth off the back of low-income workers who are just trying to get by, but the reason you'd probably make that argument is because of the high interest rates. And if you get involved in a payday loan trap, you'll eventually get to the point where the interest alone is eating your whole paycheck. The only point of mentioning all this is so you get an idea of where the opposition to interest came from related to conspiracy theories. Many Jews were targeted for partaking in these practices. When you ask, why did Hitler hate capitalism by thinking it was a creation of the Jews? Well, it's at least partially related to interest and usury. Interest can take many forms, and it's always related to loans. For example, take an employee's wage. Now, Marx would argue that the difference between what the good sells for in the market and the wage the employee was paid to produce the said good is called surplus value. So say in an hour I produce one shirt and I get paid $10, and in the market the t-shirt sells for $5. Well, Marx would argue that the employer has simply exploited the employee for $5. And to make matters worse for Marx, I'm going to quote Marx directly here, and you tell me what you think. This is from his book, Wage, Labor, and Capital, quoting him. Let us take any worker, for example, a weaver. The capitalist supplies him with the loom and the yarn. The weaver applies himself to work, and the yarn is turned into cloth. The capitalist takes possession of the cloth and sells it for 20 shillings, for example. Now, are the wages of the weaver a share of the cloth of the 20 shillings or the product of his work? By no means, period. Long before the cloth is sold, perhaps long before it is fully woven, the weaver has received his wages. The capitalist then does not pay his wages out of the money which he will obtain from the cloth, but out of money already on hand. So I don't know if you caught that. Reading this, it's almost as if Marx understood this, but later went on to polemically confuse the reader in other ways. So the important point here is that the employer is paying the employee what's called a discounted wage because the good does not sell right away, or it may not sell right away. It may never sell. The employer already took that risk to hire the labor. It may, but it may be weeks or months before the t-shirt sells. So you as an employer are getting paid the same regardless, whether it be weekly or biweekly. You're going to receive your money you were contracted to receive. The risks on the employer's part are an aspect of time. We exist in time, meaning there is a past, present, and future. So again, regardless of when the good sells, the employer has already invested in equipment, a building for production, all the fees to make the state happy, all the labor, etc. And the end result may very well be that their costs exceed their revenue. In this case, they've taken a loss. The whole point of business, and Marxists and Austrians agree completely on this point, is that you want to start a business to make profit. You want your revenue minus your cost to be not only a positive number, but hopefully a large positive number so you can sustain yourself and sustain the business, etc. People simply don't make sacrifices to be worse off than they were before. But the point of all this is that an employer seeks to make interest on their investments, and the interest in a business would be profit. This brings me to my next point about interest is that Austrians argue that when you artificially manipulate the interest rate, you screw up the whole structure of production. Let's take an example, and I used this one in the last episode. Say you have a home builder and he builds homes in bricks. Also imagine that the interest rate at this time is very low. And the reason it's low is because of central bank manipulation, so that home builders are going to see this low interest rate and think, wow, I could produce a very large house for very cheap right now. Let's do it. Now, so long as the interest rates are kept low, he could theoretically produce the home and won't have many problems. But the minute that interest rate goes up and central banks can't keep them low forever, then the home builder now has to switch his priorities. Man, if this interest rate goes up even more, I'm either going to have to build a much smaller house or I won't be able to finish this current one I'm building. If it gets to a point where the interest is just too high and he has to stop building, well, he'll either need bricks to fall out of the sky or he'll have to demolish what he built. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that if the interest rate is kept too low, the home builder may go crazy and buy too many bricks. And by the time the house is done, he's a stockpile of bricks that he won't get his money back on. So you can see right away through this example that either low or high interest rates have huge effects on production incentives in general. So what central banks do essentially is heavily manipulate the interest rates along with tinkering with the money supply. The Federal Reserve really has three methods of doing this. One is by lowering the discount rate, which is the rate banks are loaning money at. The second is by buying government bonds. And the third is by lowering the reserve ratio, which is related to how much money banks have to keep in their vaults compared to what they lend out. I think it might be better for me to dedicate a whole episode to the Federal Reserve because this is a long topic. But for now, just understand that they're in the business of manipulation. And when the economy is doing poorly, that's when they manipulate the most. A quick note about money before I jump into the Austrian business cycle theory is that money is a phenomenon of the market. Or in other words, through the voluntary interactions of individuals, it's not created by governments. That's false. Karl Menger wrote a great little book titled The Origins of Money, and it argues this exact point. But there are aspects of money that are, or at least were, universal in nature, such as they were a commonly sold commodity on the market, that the commodity is fungible, meaning it can be divided up into homogeneous units, that's durable, it's portable, it's limited in supply, and that's widely accepted. So if you notice, gold, silver, bronze, etc., these precious metals had all these characteristics. It's easy to transport them all. You can take a ounce of gold and melt it down with a pound of gold and you have 17 ounces of gold, no problem. So it's easily divisible and fungible. It was widely accepted because of its rarity and it's used for jewelry, dentistry, etc. So this is how money came about, and nothing to do with government decrees. Yet, if you studied the history of our monetary policy from the early 20th century onward, you might not know that. remember that it took a long time for the U.S. to be taken completely off the gold standard, and that it wasn't really finalized till the early 70s. When we think about money nowadays, we think about these green pieces of paper. They aren't even paper. They're a mix of cotton and linen, so it's still ever confusing. The big difference here is that you can't print more gold. You can't print more silver. You can invest and go out and mine these precious metals, but the payoff might not be worth it. But with dollars, they specifically are printed. Now, it'd be inaccurate to say the Federal Reserve itself prints money. It's a Treasury Department that prints money through the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, but it is accurate to say that the reason money gets printed is because of the actions of the Federal Reserve. When the bank needs physical cash, there's only one way to get that cash if it's not on hand. When I do an episode on the Fed, I'll go into that in detail. Now, I'm going to finish up by discussing the Austrian business cycle theory. Now, just briefly, many of you are aware of the Great Depression from 1929 to 1939, and of course, the most recent economic recession in 2008. And the common theme we see among big government proponents is that both these economic downturns were a result of a lack of government regulation, intervention, etc. They argue it was a lack of government. What the Austrians argue is exactly the opposite, namely that the tinkering of the money supply and the manipulation of interest rates screws up again the whole structure of production. And if you remember the brick building analogy from earlier, you can see that the point is that many borrowers will engage in unfeasible long-term projects. Now, of course, Marxists and Keynesians argue that boom bust cycles are an inevitable part of capitalism. This is wrong. When interest rates are kept artificially low, the expansion of credit will lead to an increase in capital spending, and the malinvestments only reveal themselves at the beginning of the crash. Here's another key point. When the bust happens, Austrians compare this to a drunk person's hangover. Look, you have two choices when you wake up with a hangover. You can either drink more alcohol and remain in the boom phase, or you can abstain from alcohol, and the latter, of course, is a smarter option. You'll get through that tough morning, maybe drink a Sprite, pop an Advil, but by the end of the day or the next day, you'll have recovered. But what if you keep drinking? Well, that's essentially what the boom period is. We just keep drinking. Getting drunk on alcohol is like getting drunk on credit. Here's the thing, though. Even economists like Milton Friedman heavily criticized the Austrian business cycle theory. You can go listen to Friedman himself. He argues that on the onset of the Depression, the money supply fell by a third, and it was the job of the Federal Reserve to print more money and fix that problem, yet they didn't. So when you hear Paul Krugman talk about the horrors of austerity, this is what he's talking about. That doing nothing, aka letting the hangover heal, is worse than giving that drunk another drink. In a lecture at the Mises Institute, Roger Garrison gave a lecture on this and pointed out that Friedman, instead of calling it a boom bust cycle, as the Austrians would, called it a bust boom cycle. So these are the basics of the Austrian business cycle theory, that the expansion of credit, which inevitably leads to a surge in the money supply, and the artificially low interest rates sets up investors to partake in malinvestments that they wouldn't have partaken in otherwise. Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, which I recommend everyone read, goes through this all in detail and with all the statistics. It's very empirical, this book. Now, one last thing I'll add to the discussion is that inflation, in the eyes of the Austrians, is the increase in the money supply. You could argue that things like the increase of prices of bread at the store and effect of inflation, namely the devaluation of our money, but you can't say that inflation is the average increase in price levels. So again, details like this are part of an ongoing debate in the sphere of economics. All right, well, thanks everyone for listening. Feel free to leave some feedback. If I missed any topics, let me know. I'll cover them in future episodes. Again, if you can, support me on patreon.com/thepeaceandlibertypodcast. My next episode, I was recently on the podcast Foreign Policy Focus with Kyle Anzalone. We discussed the economics of war, so it's going to be an episode you won't want to miss. Thank you all so much. Take care, as always, for peace and love.